Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. This episode of Value Hive is brought to you by Tegas. If you enjoy listening to Value Hive, you'll love the Tegas product. Tegas has the world's largest collection of instantly available expert interviews on all the public and private companies that you care about. All you have to do is log in. So if you're tired of high-cost and time-consuming expert research calls, give Tegas a try and see for yourself why many of the most trusted and well-respected hedge funds, mutual funds, family offices, allocators, and VCs rely on Tegas to scale their expert research and to get the critical information they need faster than ever. You can sign up for a free trial at tegas.co/valuehive. That's tegas.co/valuehive. And as a personal anecdote, I use Tegas literally every single day. It's the first resource I use when I start researching a new investment, and it's one of the last things I do before I finish up rounding out my research, and I know you'll love it as much as I do. I've got a special guest on today at Shrubbery Capital. He is known as just Shrub, for those that know him, and his Twitter handle is at Agnostocks, A-G-N-O-S. T-O-X-X-X. We have a lot to cover today. I sent out a tweet this morning, just saying, hey, I'm getting Shrub on the podcast, and we had a lot of good questions. So we'll cover everything from Shrub's background, working for event-driven funds and family offices, and his idea of recycling and how he can seamlessly transition from different industries and take what he learned from other places and apply them into seemingly esoteric ideas. So I'm very excited for this. This one has been a podcast that I've wanted to do for a while. So Shrub, first off, why the name Shrubbery Capital? Where did that come from?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Hey, Brandon, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be on your podcast finally. So I was looking for a handle, and I'm a very big fan of Monty Python. And there's that the film Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And there's the Knights of Nee. And the Knights of Nee, you know, Richard the Lionheart goes up to them and says, he wants to pass. And they say, no, we're not going to let you pass. And we want a shrubbery. I just thought it was always hilarious. You know, the Knights of Nee, all they want is a shrubbery. So I'm like, well, you know what? A hedge fund is basically a shrubbery, right? It's a hedge is a shrub. So I'm like, well, that's pretty cool. Okay, so I'm going to be Shrub Capital. as a parody account. If you want to take it a bit more philosophically as well, you had the Knights of Nee that were quite powerful and all they wanted was a shrubbery. So it's also a bit philosophical. It's like, what do you actually want in life? Well, you know, I just want a shrubbery. I want to have fun. You don't really need that much in life. So there's those two aspects to it. I'm enjoying being on Twitter. I made a lot of friends, actually made decent money, and I just enjoy the interaction with people there.
That's fantastic. When did you first get the itch for investing? Like, let's go early Shrub days when you were just a little seedling, maybe a little baby shrub, little baby hedge.
Yeah, a baby shrub. So I think my first, the first investment book I read was Peter Lynch. And I'm actually still a big fan. And whoever asks me about which book to read, it's always going to be Peter Lynch, because he made it fun. He made it also, you know, he made it accessible, and he made people curious. And I think curiosity is what makes a very good investor and a very good analyst. And that's what triggered me. I then read the Soros books, and you know, that's when you have godlike figures. But really, my first brush with a bubble was in 2000, when I was, I had a very small portfolio, and I was, you know, bear in mind, I grew up in Cyprus, which is an island in the middle of nowhere, and we had our own little bubble. I mean, it was so crazy that you had like newsagent stores listing for $1 million on the Cypriot stock exchange. So similar to that deli in New York, where you remember there was a deli this year that listed for a few hundred million.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that was, so I filled that bubble, and it was just insane to see people lose all their money, make fortunes and lose it all. So anyway, that was the first brush. Then I went to university. I got into a good university. I studied engineering, economics and management. I was, I always loved science, and I loved the process more of it, more than everything. I loved dealing in first principles. And my older engineering friends, they were all going into a subprime securitization after university. And my mentor at school, after he graduated, he told me, you have the smart guys, they're all going into RMBS, CMBS. That's where you have to go. And as an engineer, I didn't know anything. Like my background, growing up in a little island, I didn't have, that experience with the stock market more than very small things. So they were telling me, you got to go into subprime securitization, CMBS. And it sounded so exciting because I was very good at maths. So I actually went to interview for my internship at Citigroup's RMBS division. And I didn't get it. And it was like probably one of my first failures. And I was devastated. It's like, oh my God, I'm not cut for finance. And it was actually the best thing that ever happened to me, because my friend was fired two years later, and everyone who got in that program was destroyed afterwards and couldn't get a job. So The RMBS, CMBS fad of 2006, 2004, 5, 6, I mean, it was only a few years of excitement. So I ended up going into mergers and acquisitions, and against the better advice of my seniors and my teachers, because I thought that was the best way to get into the asset management industry. And M&A was a very good school. It was a very good school because it teaches you to grind, it teaches you to model, and it just gives you a very solid fundamental work. But, at my interview, actually, the guy, the head of the firm asked me, why do you want to go into M&A? And I said, because I want to get into asset management, which, it was very naive from my behalf, but I think he just appreciated the honesty at the end of the day. So then after 2 years in M&A, I just did the minimum, I just did the absolute minimum I could do. I got a job. I applied to this small merger ARP fund that was based in New York. They were opening an office in London, and they were looking for a junior analyst. And their office was literally a small room, two Bloombergs, no secretary, temporary office. It was like a WeWork of the times. It was a merger ARP fund. I had no idea what merger ARP is. And they were doing special sits, event-driven merger ARB and all that stuff. So I was so keen to get out of M&A that this sounded so exciting. And when I told my parents that I got the job, they were like, this sounds like a boiler room. What are you doing? This is crazy. But it was more than that. I mean, it was, I just loved, and actually my MD on that day, he said, when I resigned, he said, this is a big mistake. You shouldn't be going into this. This is hedge fund industry is like, it's very dark. Instead, I joined when the fund was, less than a billion. And by the time I left 5 years later, it was 40 billion. We were probably the most successful fund, special sits event driven fund. One of the top five, I would say, for that period. Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful to the guys there. because, you know, the founder was phenomenally supportive. I think he was a genius. I still think he is. He's a wonderful person. And he spent time with me. And also the head of the office spent time with me to introduce me to arbitrage. And, you know, one thing, because the younger generation of investors now, we're kind of used to the MEM stocks and all that stuff. It's important to understand where the hedge fund industry comes from. And that's why it was great to see these older guys. The hedge fund industry was based on arbitrage, you know, smart arbitrage. You know, we would try to make 1% out of a deal closing and risk 20%. So it was very specialized arbitrage trades. You know, merger arbitrage, I don't know if you know much about it. I can just go very quickly.
So go ahead and dive into merger arb. Just give us like a 30,000 foot view, because on the surface, right, if we're talking about risk adjusted returns and kind of asymmetric opportunities, risking 20% for that 1% on the surface is like, wow, that sounds like a pretty risky proposition. But again, you're talking about maybe potential 90, 95% certainty that this thing is going to work. So give us that.
Exactly. 1, exactly. 30, so risk arbitrage. Exactly. So risk arbitrage is one of the purest forms of a hedge fund. You're basically, an acquirer makes an offer for a company. Say they make an offer for $20 and the stock is trading at $19. There's a dollar spread. You're trying to capture that dollar until the deal closes. And that is predicated on getting regulatory clearances, getting financing in place, and whatever other conditions. So you're trying to see what probability there is for the deal to close, and you are trying to get a risk adjusted return, which is very attractive because you're basically recreating a bond like profile.
Right.
If you're an institution and you want to diversify your holdings away from equities and credit, well, this is where hedge funds actually add value, because they're adding a diversified income stream or return stream to an institution. But of course, this is just one part of risk arbitrage, where where the founder of my first job was, you know, very, very smart, was by recognizing the other aspects of risk arbitrage. So for example, one thing actually, the primary principle of the plays was, and I carry it to this day, is take care of the downside and the upside will take care of itself. This is very, very important.
Right.
Because in risk arbitrage, your downside could be significant. So that's why it teaches you to have a process. And it teaches you to respect the downside. What it also teaches you is, because the returns are so small, you always try to find other ways around it. For example, you could actually short the deal. If there's a spin-off or if there's a share deal, you can play the pro forma value of the deal. So for example, one very easy way to make money is, you know, I remember one deal, was a semiconductor company actually. So they say it was a 100 billion company. They were buying a 10 billion company and the stock of the acquirer went down 20%. So they lost 20 billion of value buying something that was 10 billion. So, you know, immediately we just piled in, and, you know, I bought a ton of stock on the acquirer, and, you know, it shouldn't lose 20 billion. It lost 10 billion in the end. So, you know, you make a quick 10%. So by doing these, risk adjusted trades, you can actually optimize your returns. But I think, so the genius part of our event book pre 2006-07 was that we were doing all these arbitrage strategies. We were doing all these, spin-offs, etc. But the founder also had this overlay of a subprime hedge. So he said, I'm going to spend 1 or 2% a year as a hedge. And, you know, if the credit bubble bursts, then we're going to make a fortune. But he used that as a hedge. And that's what got us, you know, in 2008, you know, and we, by the way, we were laughing in 2007, 2006, seven, we were laughing. Every month this trade was losing money. Losing like 20 bips. And then one day it just went boom. And it went boom every day for like a long time. Wow. So, you know, we ended up 2008, like triple digit, which made a big difference. And 2009 as well. So, but, you know, just the transition of the shrub though was going from a 1 billion fund to something that grew to 40 billion, it meant I started becoming more away from special sits as well as fundamentally. So, you know, I had a very big trade on in 2007-08. I spent 1 year of my life shorting European financials, for example. I literally spent 1 year of my life on that trade. And then in 2009, I spent a year of my trade in mining because it was the recovery of, especially the Chinese recovery. So, you know, I went to China a couple of times and gained some insight that helped me in the current setup. And in 2011, I think because the fund became so big and I was actually itching to become a portfolio manager of my own, I moved to another fund to become a portfolio manager. Really enjoyed myself because I was structuring my own trades, learning from a different perspective, and also had a very different risk management approach because it was more of a prop desk setup. The risk management was very, very different. So for example, at my first firm, I'll give you a very simple example. In the first firm, I had a short that went up 50%. And the PM was like, why is it up? And I said, I have no idea. So he doubled up. And it went down 80%. I mean, we made a killing out of that. In my next fund, if the stock was offside by 10%, I wouldn't even be asked about what happened to the stock. It would just disappear from the portfolio. So the portfolio manager, you know, the main portfolio manager would just say, you know what, do whatever you want. But if you're offside by 10%, you're down. You're out.
Yep.
As in your position is out. So that was very useful because it made me a bit paranoid. And actually, you know, it's both my strength and my weakness, I think, that I have a very tight risk management. Mm-hmm. I don't really let something go down more than, say, whatever, 20% or 10% if it's a bigger position, which, you know, means I'm never going to write something to crazy levels or, you know, I'm never going to have a very, you know, high beta portfolio. And then I transitioned from that hedge fund to a pot shop briefly, and then COVID hit, and I got stranded from my family. So I joined the family office of a friend of mine in Monaco that I'm running now. So right now, basically, I'm running my own capital and a friend's capital through his family office, and it's a very interesting setup to see the difference between a main hedge fund with big positions, a pot shop, and a family office. It's just fascinating to see the differences and also how you generate capital with different risk parameters. Because, you know, in the first case, you can accept volatility, and that volatility can actually go against you if you're wrong. And actually, my first fund did very, very badly after I left. Not because of me, it just so happened. 2011, they had an outsized bet in something that went wrong. So that's one example. Whereas, you know, the family office, they're, you know, you're preserving the wealth of a family. So, and also I'm managing my own money at the same time. And, you know, it always brings back the Buffett principle. When you feel the money next to you, you know, you just don't lose money. That's your principle. You just can't lose money. Don't lose money. Don't lose money. Because that keeps you in the game. Because ultimately, you just have to stay in the game and last in the game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing I've seen is I've seen people just drop out of the game for various reasons. And actually, if there's one thing I think I'd love people to get out of this conversation is, you know, find ways to stay in the game, because there's a lot of ways to stay in the game. I'll just give you an example of how I learned the tough way personally. Like when I was young, I took an account, I took, you know, decent money in the account. I did a 10X.
As you
do. And then I lost it. As you do. And then I lost it. Yeah.
How'd you lose it?
But then I lost it. So I lost it by literally, I can curse on your podcast, right?
Yeah, of course.
Excellent. So I lost it around by fucking around with futures.
Okay.
And by just betting against the market. So I made it all 10. So I made it 10x in 1 year. Felt I was a genius. And it was decent money as well. I did it by going the right way of the market. And then the market turned. And the reason why I was doing futures is because the only thing I was allowed to do PA was futures. I wasn't allowed to do single stocks. So okay. I wasn't like the Fed officials that can do single names.
Yeah.
You know, I had a very strict PA policy all my life, except now. So that's why I can feel comfortable tweeting about names. But anyway, so I was only messing around with futures. I did it 10x. And then what happened actually was, I remember what happened. It was the European crisis that was triggered by the Greeks. It was always the fucking Greeks. it was Tsipras. He started he launched the elections to get out of the euro. So anyway, so that basically I was 10 times levered and I just blew up. So I lost everything on that one. It felt like it felt gamified. It was like a gamified process. So that's why I'm a bit careful now. And I know, I see young people as well on Twitter. That's why, I interact with a lot of young guys on Twitter. Not that I'm old, but, this is the danger of Robinhood and everything. It's like the gamification of investing. And actually, I learned a lot more investing by investing my own capital than by being in a hedge fund, believe it or not. So I think having left the hedge fund and trading my own account made me a much better investor. Because I would always get upset losing money, even if it wasn't, at every point in my career, I was always upset losing money. But once you feel your account go to zero and you're like, shit.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's been there. I mean, you're nodding and you're like, well, yeah, okay. Yeah. So it is a hard lesson and it's a good lesson to carry with you, especially with, a small percentage of your total wealth or so small, not a significant amount of your wealth.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of those things too, where, futures is an interesting market because, and this is why I love the Market Wizards book so much, is because you have guys that, and for the most part, this is relatively only possible in the futures market where you can make a ton of money rather quickly starting out with a small amount just because of the leverage. Guys like Michael Marcus or Peter Brandt that have legendary careers have all blown up multiple times before they kind of nailed it. But if you were to go back, because there's this big dichotomy that I'm sensing between what you learned at the event-driven fund and what you've learned at a family office, if you could go back and kind of say, if I only had to pick one of these to do to learn about how I want to invest over my lifetime, which one would you choose and why?
Sorry, you mean between hedge funds and family office or?
Yeah.
Or just, I think it's the hedge fund. I would really recommend people to have that, even at a prop shop, actually. I mean, I think it's a big shame that we don't have prop shops in Europe anymore. I don't know if in the US what's happening, but, the best traders I met came out of prop shops because they respected the risk. Also, most family offices are a bit sleepy.
So what do you mean by that?
Sleepy in the sense, based in Monaco, I interact with a lot of them and they're extremely conservative. They only want to put money in index and single A bonds to get some yield. And I'm lucky enough that the founder, and who's a very close friend of mine, he actually made his money. He's an 80-year-old young person, Warren Buffett style, made all his money in oil and gas, mining, real estate, litigation, and very weird places. So he's very excited about staying on top of things. Like he understands things. Whereas if you see the European family offices, they're mostly sleepy. And the US is a bit different because you do have long histories. You have long, very mature family offices. Mm-hmm. And of very vast wealth, so they can do a lot of things. Whereas in Europe, it's a bit different. Like you see, for example, the shipping family offices, because their main business is so risky, if you ask them what they do with their personal money, they say, we only buy real estate. Because they say, I can't really have volatility in my main business and in my bank account. So I would, you know, so the recommendation I have is definitely have the experience of a hedge fund, because what you learn in a hedge fund is you learn the risk management. First of all, you learn, if you have a good mentor, you learn a solid analysis. And I think the analysis, you know, I'm a very big proponent of first principles. So everyone should learn the first principles. Everyone should learn the basics. The basics are, one, you should know how to do some basic multiples. I don't really care about modeling. I do all my modeling on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. So my investments, and we can talk about the other, you know, investments later on, but I literally model them on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
I refuse to do an Excel for my investments, but I want to have the multiple. And so these are the first principles. I want to have the multiple. I want to know what's going on. That's the first thing. The second thing you learn from a hedge fund is to structure the trade. And a lot of people really fuck this up.
So give me an example of properly structuring a trade and then improperly structuring a trade.
Absolutely. Yeah. So a very simple example is see what's available. So I, for example, I'm long Twitter right now, and Twitter has been a shit show.
My condolences.
I know. But here's what I own. I own the Twitter 2024 convertible. Ooh. So the 24 convertible is at a $52 strike. I bought it at 117. It went to 140 when the stock had a run up to like $70, $80 or something. But then the stock now is at 44. So the stock is down, what, close to 50%?
Yeah.
And my convertible went from 117 to 110. I don't give a shit. That's how you structure. This is a very simple way of saying, I'm going to look what's available, what the market is offering me to save my ass if something goes wrong. That's how you watch the downside to let the upside take care of itself. This is a very basic way. And the reason why this happens is because, you know, there's always optionality on the convertible. You have 2 years left. The volatility will remain high. So the worst I could lose was 20%. Okay, fine. I can afford to lose 20% on a trade that I really like. So that was fine. Another example of a way you structure a trade well, and this is something I learned from my second boss and I'm very grateful for, is especially if you're dabbling with options, just get your timeline right. So if you get your timeline right in an option trade, you're going to make a killing.
Yeah.
And last year's example I give is Wirecard. So Wirecard, we always knew was a fraud. Wirecard is this German payments company. It's been accused to be a fraud for the last, I don't know, 5 years.
Right.
And you know, it was really obvious, by the way, because, you know, they used to process payments for the porn industry and the gambling industry. So it was... like, dude, it was in your face. But anyway, so, and I didn't bother with it. And I know a lot of people that got burned on the short side. And I actually know one guy who made a killing on the long side. But what happened last year in 2020, there was always this short seller that was coming out against them, but there was an investigation. There was an audit that was going to get released by the auditor, and they gave a date for the release. And I think that date was like the 17th of June. I think it was like, initially they said like 1st of June, and then they delayed it to 17th of June. Mm-hmm. So there were some 18th of June and September puts available. So with the stock at 90, I was like, you know what? It's a fraud. But no one believed that it's going to come out. It's like, you know what? Let's just spend a bit of money and we buy some 60 euro puts and 40 euro puts. So, you know, I bought some, you know, if the thing was out on the 17th, I bought on the 18th. And then I bought that, you know, 17th of June was the outcome, and I bought 18th of June puts. And then I bought September puts, same thing. So I would spend like a dollar. If it was a fraud, I'd make 10. So that, you know, very simple timeline trade. Nothing more. I didn't go through the whole hassle of the short sellers and all that stuff. And then the audit came out, and I actually thought it was going to be positive for Wirecard because, you know, these guys were so embedded in the whole system. And it came out that it's a fraud. You know, the money was missing. So our puts on the September puts we had, I think, went up 10 times, but the June ones went up like 20 times. I mean, wow. And I was like, holy shit. I kind of just, and you know, it was a tough year, 2020. I think I was down by that point on the year.
Yeah.
And that kind of just put us positive. I'm like, oh my God, it was like a gift in the sense, you know, we've done everything right. We got the timeline right. We got the structure right. And we didn't risk much. You know, we risked like, you know, whatever, 20, 30 bips of the portfolio, less than 50 bips of the portfolio. You can do the numbers. I mean, it, you know, it made a big difference to us. So this is how you structure a trade. So the other guys, they were shorting the trade from like 90, so it'd go to 200, had the full volatility, went through the whole hassle. You know, I don't want to go through that. I want to just have like the timeline where the trade is going to work or not. If it didn't work, I would have just given up. So that's an example of a timeline trade. And actually, if you think about timelines in the same way, there's a lot of nice events that come out of that. I mean, one of the names I mentioned was Magnachip, for example. We can just discuss later. You know, that's it was a company that was bid for by the Chinese. But CFIUS, so the U.S. Foreign Investment Authority, they were just saying, we will review the deal and make a decision by the X day of December. And it was obviously going to break. It was obviously going to block it because, you know, Chinese company buying a semiconductor company. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the day they blocked it, okay, the thing is done. There's a break fee. It's a very cheap stock. So that's when you buy the bloody thing. So you put on your radar and that's when you do it. So that's where, you know, special sits investing becomes really interesting for me, especially because I have limited capital. I'm using my capital and the family office. So the timeline just helps me size my trades and structure my trades well, because, you know, I need to rotate. It's not like I'm not just sitting there, you know, with my capital waiting for something. I'm actually rotating my capital. And the way I do it, because I want to make money, I need to make money. You know, that's why I would have a list of events with dates and possible outcomes. And then you find the best one and you size and you size your bet on that. Now on the hedge fund, the other thing too that you learn is what I said about the risk management, how you stop loss things.
Right.
And stop lossing is something that we couldn't do when I was at the big hedge fund, let's put it this way. But you see, the stop lossing is a part of the culture of the pod shop and the smaller funds. And and you know, this has been very frustrating, but it's also saved my ass multiple times. So I'll give you a trick that I've learned over the years is if you're gonna buy something that it looks really shitty and technical terms, then you really need to have a stop loss.
Yep.
So for example, BABA, right? BABA in 2021. I mean, the technicals look shit. Yeah, exactly. But it looks shit. But I did okay just playing bounces on BABA. And then before results, I decided to buy calls. I bought calls. Okay. And they went to zero. Okay, fine. And then I was like, okay, fine. So I made a bit of money on BABA on the bounces and I lost it on the calls. Fine, whatever. But then it just keeps going down. You know, there's no point chasing it down. I mean, fundamentally, you know, it's below the 200 DMA. It's a death cross. No one gives a shit about China. Everyone wants to get out of China. You know, don't chase it down. Wait for something to settle. Probably a good time to buy, whatever. It doesn't matter. But if you're going to buy BABA, you need to have a stop loss, right? That's it. If you're going to buy something, something that respects technicals, and I actually want to touch on this because I saw that we were the only ones who defended Minervini a bit during the whole fiasco with
Minervini. I mean, this is a great conversation to have. So I'm glad we're going down this rabbit hole.
Yeah, I think we should go because it's important for people. Because, you know, in the hedge fund industry, people are very arrogant as such, or, you know, or very elitists, because we, you know, most of us came from a banking background. So, you know, it's about the DCF and the bullshit this and the bullshit that. But in reality, you know, you can be a great trader without using any of that and just using some basic growth metrics and just respecting certain technicals.
Yes.
And I actually enjoyed the Minervini books a lot. I read all of them.
Yeah, me too.
And to be honest, to Minervini, he actually just summarized all the other books from, you know, Murphy and the other guys. I forgot what the other technical, I mean, there's a few really
Edwards,
good technical
Edwards
guys.
And McGee were kind of the
Edwards and OGs. McGee, exactly. Exactly. The Market Wizards guys as well. I mean, those are the best books in the world. I love those books. And, you know, Mark, I think, condensed it quite well. And I think it is a good read. And a lot of hedge fund guys don't respect technicals. And that's how you, as a retail guy, because a lot of these hedge funds are so big right now that they can't really respect technicals. I mean, I've been there. You know, when you have a $50 million position or $100 million position, and it breaks at 200 DMA, the last thing you want to do as an analyst is go to your PM and say, oh, it broke the 200 DMA. Can we please sell? I mean, you're going to look like a fucking idiot, right? It's going to tell you, why? Did something change in the company? No. But, you know, as a retail holder, you know, if you're a retail investor and you're listening to this, you know, you're not, you know, that $50 million guy is probably going to sell 20% lower in the end. Meanwhile, the algos that are trading, you know, the Renaissance algos that trade on the 200 DMA are going to be smashing it down 20%. Yep. So you might as well just preempt it. So, you know, one very simple survival skill I have is to respect technicals. And just, you know, if you have a trade that is trading on technicals, just put a bloody stop loss around those technicals. Right? I mean, I think you've read your fair share of technicals as well to know that it kind of works sometimes.
Yeah. And the reason this is, you know, kind of a tad bit of me going on a soapbox, but it's because I think I have enough knowledge in technicals as well as in maybe the fundamental aspects of things, to where I can kind of opine on this with a little bit more confidence. And, you know, just kind of touching on the Minervini example, it was terrible optics, right? Like, there's no getting around that. Like, the way he handled that was hilariously bad. Didn't make him look good. But at the end of the day, there's so many ways to skin the cat. And I think if you peel back the Minervini example, right? Because that's pretty polarizing. But, like, let's meet in the middle ground with someone like Michael Burry, who got his start trading commodity futures, trading cocoa futures, and the only way that he did that was actually from a technical perspective. So he didn't use fundamentals trading futures; he only traded technicals. And then when he transitioned into stocks, one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that he kept that technical foundation, where he even says in his letters, he says, look, I buy a lot of roadkill and I buy a lot of stocks that are bouncing along their lows. And one of the rules he had in place was, I'll buy a stock around the lows. If it makes new lows, I cut and I just move on and I just wait. And I think a lot of investors kind of miss that whole process because it doesn't fit well into their narrative of, you know, this whole value investing camp where you buy a business, you don't care about the share price, and you just kind of let Mr. Market do whatever it does. And there's truth to that, right? Like, there is definitely a style where it's, you focus solely on the business, who cares what the stock does, and you hold for a long time. And that works very, very well. But the other side is you can incorporate some technicals and you can kind of incorporate some of these bare bones tactics and really add value to your process if it fits your personality. And where I think a lot of investors go wrong is that they simply dismiss it because it doesn't sound as philosophically, you know, enchanting, basically. And it doesn't kind of feed their ego of them saying, like, oh, like, I just focus on the business. I'm this high and mighty business analyst. And, you know, I've kind of gone off on a tangent here, but I just agree with you because there are so many ways to make money. And if you add these ways, And you know, I've tweeted about this before. I've gotten dunked on by Dan Loeb for shorting. I think it was, I shorted Shopify purely based on technicals and, you know, put my stop loss in, and yeah, I got dunked on and it was fun. But you know, if you add these tools, then you just become a better participant in markets because you know how others are thinking in the game.
Absolutely. I mean, if you understand the participants, you understand the game as well. And it's just very important to know which game we're playing, right? So that's why it's interesting you said that about Michael Burry, because I have a barbell approach in my portfolio. You know, on one hand, I have the really cheap stuff that I will stop loss accordingly, but I also have, you know, what I would consider I have something that's very thematic that I think is going to last me a few years. And I also have a couple of stocks that I think could be 10 baggers that don't fit anywhere else in my thinking. You know, they don't have multiples and they don't have anything. And so,
yeah.
So I think the barbell approach is what works. It's just, you know, I mean, you see from Twitter, some ideas are, I put as, it's not just mining, it's something else, or, you know, it's in recycling or something. That's why I think what I enjoy doing and what I love doing, I love investing, and I'm very curious about stuff. And I get into down a rabbit hole where I find something and I get excited and I just find more and more and more and more. And actually, you know, I mean, I started getting excited about tin this year, and I found this whole community on Twitter, the Tin Barons, that is legendary. And, you know, we've all made money together. I mean, we're up like 100, 150% on our names. And equally, you know, there's the Utahs, the, you know, uranium bulls in Twitter that are, you know, another cool community. But, you know, the funny part is, and it goes back to your point about, you know, maybe what works or what's the audience, what are the players? Let's see what the players are. So the tin stocks, for example, there's only two listed tin producers in the Western world. They trade on like 2-3 times EBITDA. And on the other hand, you have a bunch of uranium stocks. They're trading on like 20-30 times EBITDA. And actually, there's a lot of non-producers that are just pump and dump schemes.
Yeah.
And both the tin industry and the uranium industry is around $10 billion a year. But what are the differences? On the side of tin, it's a very niche metal, and so only specialists care about it right now. And on the other hand, uranium is actually the solution to our whole energy crisis, and it's going to become ESG next year. I'm actually long both because, you know, because I'm going to make money on both. So why, I'm not going to tell myself, oh, you know what, I'm not going to own Cameco because it's on, you know, X multiple. I mean, I know it's going to go up next year, so I'm going to be long Cameco, but at a different weight to my tin stocks, for example. Mm-hmm. So you know, this is how I approach it. And, you know, I do try to avoid elitism, and that's why I enjoy with the family office and running my own capital, because, you know, I understand where the hedge fund guys are coming from, especially if you're running a smaller hedge fund. You want to keep your investors. So, you know, if you write an investor letter and you put a stock on, you're committed. You know, you're committed to that stock. So immediately you're going to start defending it and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I put a stock on Twitter and, you know, this guy actually put Groupon, right? And Groupon is, I mean, it's a piece of shit. I know it's a piece of shit. You know, it went from like 100 to 20. Of course it's a piece of shit. But, you know, they, you know, just a quick summary, it's a $600 million company nowadays. It's on 5x EBITDA, and they have a venture capital asset that's done extremely well. If you strip it out, it's on 3x EBITDA. And next year they're launching, you know, on my timeline trade, next year they're launching a partnership with Google and Square. So I have a timeline that next year, this piece of shit could actually become a less piece of shit and go from 3x EBITDA to 5x EBITDA. And it goes back from 23 to 40. And if it actually works, it can go from 40 to 100. So, So that's my, you know, 3-4x. That I'm okay with that. So anyway, this smart friend of mine on Twitter said, you know, this Groupon, it's a piece of shit. I'm like, yeah. And he said, oh, you know, all their offerings are crap. And I was like, yeah, I know. Look at the chart. But I hear you. You know, if I see it doesn't work, I'm out. I'm not telling you to buy it. I don't care. I'm not writing an investor letter to convince you of my strategy. I'm just putting it out there. You take it or leave it.
Yeah.
So I do feel for the guys that are running funds that are putting out the ideas, and I respect them. But you know, also retail investors, and you know, I'm always aware that their incentives are different. There is a marketing element, and they're committed to that trade. And a lot of them, I've seen it many, many times when they just, the thesis changes and they just get stuck with it. I mean, that's just really, really sad. And I think one guy who was very guilty of that is the Greenlight guy, right? Yeah, so he Einhorn. Was always like, oh yeah, Einhorn. I mean, dude, seriously, you know, you can just say you were wrong and just get out. You know, instead he just had like terrible year after terrible year. Or Odie, same thing. I mean, terrible year after terrible year. I mean, he's a different story because he's stubborn. But, you know, it's always important, again, going back to the point is, and I shouldn't be shitting on good investors that have made it, but, you know, it's always worth being aware because I don't like people getting idolized in this industry.
Going back to your point on marrying an idea, it's something that I have not struggled with, but I hold two opinions in my head, and I'm interested to get your feedback. Is, you know, the first opinion is one of the ways to generate long-term wealth, generational wealth, life-changing returns is to fall in love with a company that you truly believe in, that is executing properly, and it is only through that adoration that you can endure the drawdowns. And that's kind of one opinion. And I don't know the weight of the truth in that in my head. But then the other opinion is look, the market doesn't care that you own it. The stock doesn't care that you own it. Company also doesn't care that you own it. Unless, of course, you're an activist and you've got a board seat, totally different. But in general, company doesn't care that you own the stock. And when, especially on Twitter, when you start going public about the ideas, this is where I think a lot of investors could kind of learn from more traders, more discretionary technical traders.
Right. Yeah.
Guys like Druckenmiller, where they'll go on CNBC and they'll say, hey, like, this is what I think. I'm long these names, but I could be wrong tomorrow and I could change my mind tomorrow. And part of me wonders how much of that is a crux on the investor side because of this idea of the punch card, and you only get 20 punches. And God forbid if you punch a hole and it's wrong, but you have to live with it because you punched that card. And so, like, I'm just kind of wrestling with these two things in my head, because on one hand, you can make a ton of money by being stubborn in a name and saying, no, I love this company. I believe in it. It's good. Like, it's going to work. But you can also make a lot of money saying, look, I don't really care what happens. Like, here's my idea. Here's why I think it would be right. If someone tells me I'm wrong and the evidence is disconfirming, then sure, I'm wrong. Who cares?
You know what? This is one of the most important discussions you can have around investing, 100%. And I actually think about it a lot. And one guy I have a lot of respect for, and you know, we follow each other on Twitter, surprisingly, is Emmett Peppers, the guy who wrote Tesla to $50 million or something. So he was a UBS guy. And he was putting all his money on Tesla. Tesla calls, Tesla, 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 doubling up. And he turned to $50 million and retired. Or, you know, the Roaring Kitty guy, right? The GME guy.
Yeah. Yep.
So those are great stories. And, you know, I have immense respect for him because I could never do what he did. The problem with that, first of all, I have two very big baggages that prevent me from doing what he did. I actually have a few. So the first one is I learned to invest in Europe. And in Europe, most of the companies are shit. And he learned to invest in the US. And in the US, it's a very different mentality, right? So my European companies, badly run, no upside, value traps, etc. He learned in the US, innovators, driven managers, and found Elon Musk.
Yep.
That's one. The second baggage I have, I think he was a middle office guy. I was a front office guy. So I have the baggage of the burden of knowledge, you know, having stuff that went to zero suddenly. So, you know, I tweeted once my worst trade ever, not in dollar terms, but as a hurtful experience, mm-hmm. that I was invested. So when I resigned from my first job, a garden leave. And I took my girlfriend, who's now my wife, I took her to Thailand in the most expensive hotel I ever booked since. And I was really chilled. And I wasn't allowed to invest PA. So as soon as I resigned, I bought this coal stock in Indonesia.
I like where this is going.
You know, So that my three smartest friends were doing so much work on this thing. You know, it's like great coal, met coal deposit. It's trading on, gonna trade on 1x EBITDA. It's gonna kill it. They're gonna get the license, yabida, yabida. So anyway, so it looked like, and by the way, back then there was a massive coal run like now. So, you know, ANR was a 10 billion company, Arch Coal was 5 billion. So, you know, this little deposit in Indonesia was like really attractive. So anyway, so we go to, I'm on a garden leave. I'm in this hotel, Rayavadi in Krabi. I'll never forget it. It was like so expensive. And I'm sitting, I'm sorry to be graphical, but I'm sitting on the toilet seat. And my friend texts me and said, oh shit, did you see what happened with Churchill? I said, no. And I checked the share price and it was down like 90%. The company was called Churchill Mining. It was like the stock was down like 90%. And I just jumped from the toilet seat. I'm like, holy shit. This is like my dream holiday. I panic. I go to my girlfriend's like, and I had like a maybe 10% position, something that went to zero. And I panic. And what happened was these guys, they did have a good coal deposit, but and there was a sale process, mm-hmm. but one Indonesian oligarch wanted the bloody thing. So he basically bribed people to expropriate the asset. So the whole thing was expropriated and it stayed in court for like years. And it was a complete shit show, but you know, that's just one example. So that thing just went to zero. I mean, you can have so many mistakes from this story. Like I got a tip from a friend, you know, we did the work with friends. It was like bias. I mean, there's so many things wrong with it. So, it, you know, it's very dangerous. Not everyone is, you know, like Emmett Peppers. Not everyone is Elon Musk. There's only one Tesla. There's only one Amazon. Mm-hmm. Most things are a piece of shit. And I'm lucky that it was only a 10% position. Because, you know, I can recover from that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, this Emmett Peppers, I think he was all in on Tesla. So psychologically, it's very difficult. So the way I do it, because I do play... a few of these life-changing companies. So the way I do it, because I'm a value-oriented special sits guy, I say, you know what? I can have one or two of these in my portfolio.
Yeah.
But I prevent myself from having more than that because then I don't feel comfortable because then I end up recreating ARK, you know, the Cathie Wood portfolio. And this is the last thing I want because I don't feel comfortable with that. So for example, 2020, you know, I had one stock and unfortunately it was underweight. I was long Plug Power in 2020. So I had it, I actually had it in 2019. It was OD was pitching it at the SON conference. It was a $1 billion company. And in 2020, it had this massive run. It went from like 2 to 18. And I was very happy because, you know, my 2% position became 20%. But I did an increase. I didn't do anything. And, you know, I sold because the CFO sold all his stock. The CEO sold all the stock. Everyone sold all their stocks. I'm like, I'm going to get the fuck out. So I sold. And then the stock went to like 70. But you know what? They printed more shares for themselves. So they got more shares to sell.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing with Plug is... I never feel comfortable with certain managers as well. So for example, with Plug Power, you could tell the guy was a promoter. Right. I mean, Elon Musk is a promoter. I mean, I think the guy's a genius. Whereas Plug, you know, the guy's a promoter. You know, is Plug Power worth anything more than 10 billion? No. So, okay, I'm happy to sell there. And, you know, right now I have a couple of those stocks in my portfolio for the same reason. It's stuff that I think can do 10x. It's just right now, the way I've changed it is I'm thinking, you know what? I'll go from 2% to 5%. But the mistake I did with Plug Power is, as you see, like milestones getting hit, mm-hmm. I shouldn't be afraid to increase my position, especially right. as the technicals were getting respected. Because if you see the chart of Plug Power, it was respecting the 50 DMA, I think, or the 20 DMA, like yeah. for a year. Like it yeah. was like a perfect technical trade. You could have ridden the whole thing just by saying, you know what? It broke out. Just ride it until it breaks the technicals. And you would have made like 20, 30 times your money.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at it right now. Like it broke on April 16th of 2020. Well, really April 14th, 16th. It broke above its 50-day at like 425. And then it did not have two consecutive closes below the 50-day until February of 2021, when it was at $50, $49.
Yeah. Whereas I sold at 18, I remember very well. And I was riding the technical. And the only reason I sold was because all the managers got out of their stock. I think the CFO sold all his stock. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, you know what? If he's selling everything, I'm going to sell everything. I didn't think, well, he's going to print more.
Yeah.
But if I just rode the technical chart, I would have made another. Instead of 10x, I would have made like 30x and changed my life, you know?
Yep.
So I think going back to your original point, because I think it's very important. You don't want to be long. And by the way, Plug Power, I had a small position and it was dead for a year. If you see the chart, it was like stuck at $2 for a year. So he pushed it in summer 2019 and it didn't move until April 2020, right? Or something like that. Yep. So... And before that, it was dead for years, since the 2001 crash. I mean, if you see the chart, it's crazy. It went like up 100 times, down to 90%, and then back to where it is now. So anyway, back to the point, because it's a very useful lesson. The most difficult thing, and by the way, the reason why I sold after, it was not only because he sold, is because it became real money. So it becomes real money and you kind of, you know what? I want to take it. So yeah. I sold half and then I sold another half, whereas I should have let some run. But someone like Druckenmiller could have said, you know what? It's doing well. Just leave it and actually add. I mean, Stevie Cohen would have just added, right?
Yep.
And I think this is one part that I would say it needs work for me, you know, to say it's doing well. I feel comfortable adding to companies that add to milestones, but where there's value, but it's more difficult to add something like a Plug, for example. Mm-hmm. But if you want to have a 10 bagger, well, you know, you got to chase some of that stuff, unfortunately. Well, not necessarily true. I mean, you can also buy, you know, there was like one, two times EBITDA value stocks that actually respect technicals very well. And a few of the stocks were long now, you know, what I call the one times EBITDA basket. They do respect the technicals and actually it looks, you know, they look pretty good. I mean, you know, one stock that was pitched on Twitter by Josh Young was Sandridge. I mean, Sandridge was following technicals beautifully for a year and a bit. Mm-hmm. Or Arch. I mean, I've been long Arch for a year. That's been following it nicely. The tin stocks, Alphamin, has been following it nicely. So you know these are good setups when they're cheap,
like, yeah.
You know, few times EBITDA and they respect the technicals and people don't own them. We think they own them because we're part of small communities on Twitter, but actually people don't really own them, and that's what I love about this market right now is that, you know, going back to our original point about the players, you know, one thing that came in this market that distorted the game and the players is ESG. ESG made a big difference. And I felt it big time in Europe because, you know, ESG is the devil spawn of Europe. You know, we had carbon credits first and we have the ESG mandate. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember speaking to a friend of mine that manages a few billion and I was pitching him some oil stocks, actually Royal Dutch Shell when it was close to like 10% dividend or something forward. And he said, oh, you know what? I can't own Royal Dutch Shell because, you know, ESG, it's very tough for me to own it. You know, it's against what my investors want. So, you know, as a personal investor, as a family office, if you don't have those restraints, it's a great market to invest. Because on one hand, you have really overvalued shit that you don't want to touch anyway. And on the other side, you have like really cheap stuff that trade on low multiples, that respect the technicals. They're going to pay out them, you know, they're going to pay out their market cap in a few years. And no one wants them, which is great.
Well, the other thing with ESG investing, and I touched on this in a podcast with Dan McMurtry, but if you remove your own opinions about it, it doesn't really matter what you think is stupid or not, because at the end of the day, if the majority of people respect ESG and want to make it a core philosophy of their investments, then it is a real thing. Even if you think it's fake, even if you think it's BS, like you have to adjust. I mean, I had something similar where I was pitching this smaller cap, you know, company that was involved in ammunition and guns and all those things. And one of the guys responded. He said, hey, you know, I love this idea. I would love to own it, but my clients don't want to own anything related to guns. And I was like, I get it. Like,
there you
go. That's a legitimate headwind.
I think a very important thing to clarify. I don't like to piss against the wind. I was actually very long ESG themes in Europe. I was long NG, EDF, you know, RWE. These are utilities that, you know, were very cheap as well. And they were ESG because they had the renewables. In fact, I think I made the money on Plug because of ESG. I mean, it wasn't because I was a genius or because Plug is worth anything more than it is.
Right.
That's the ESG thing. So those were wins. And, you know, the recycling theme as well that we can talk about later. I mean, that's an ESG theme. Those were wins because of ESG. But ESG also gives you the opportunity at the same time to buy the beaten up stuff like, you know, the coals and the oil and gases and stuff like that. But with a very big warning sign that I'm going to put now, that I own a coal stock. You know, I've owned Arch from the 40s, and now it's at whatever, close to 195. But it's, you know, it's 1x EBITDA or 2x EBITDA. So the oil stocks are 3x EBITDA. So if you want to be bearish about the oil industry, just look at what happened to the coal industry. Like, no one owns coal. I speak to the only coal analyst in the US. I ask him who owns these things, and he said the same guys over the last, you know, it's the same 10 guys. Yep. Plus retail. So no one can own these things. So you have to be very aware that you do have a significant risk of derating. That's why when I think about structuring my portfolio, because I have a very big position in energy. You know, I've tweeted about this, that I think there's a risk of a stagflationary environment. And in a stagflationary environment, historically, energy is the best performing asset. And we have an energy crisis in Europe, so I want to have an exposure to the energy industry. Mm-hmm. But I have a portfolio approach to energy. I own oil and gas stocks, and I own Arch, and I own uranium, because uranium is getting in the ESG basket. Europe has designated nuclear as a green energy. So the ESG industry is $10 trillion. If they want to play the energy theme, I think they're going to start buying uranium at some point. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, I mean, I don't know if you know this, the whole thing about the Sprott ETF and all that, but,
I don't know, like, if there's any,
yeah, I mean, I'll just give you the very brief, bull case, because, you know, there's on Twitter, we have like the tin barons and the uranium guys. And we're like, you know, we're like, becoming family almost now. So I'll just run the case very quickly. So look, uranium, the annual production is 125 pounds a year. Mm-hmm. The consumption is 180 pounds a year. But there's also 125 million production, 180 million pounds consumption, and there's 25 million pounds of secondary supply. Mm-hmm. So there's a 30 million pound deficit a year. The reason why that is since Fukushima and since the USSR dismantling, there's a very big stockpile above ground. And, you know, that uranium was, I don't know where it was, like $60 a pound or something. And now, and then it went down to like in the 20s. And I've been hearing about the bull case in uranium for years. But no one knows the stockpile above ground. It could be like, you know, 3 years consumption or whatever. So suddenly you have Sprott coming and saying, we're going to launch a trust and we're going to start buying above ground or, you know, we're going to start buying uranium. And, you know, people didn't take it seriously, but now Sprott has bought about 40 million pounds. That's about a third of annual production. So suddenly you have a financial player that bought a third of the annual production. So who's sucking out the deficit? So already there's a deficit, annual deficit that we're trying to work through. So this guy comes in and says, you know, I'm going to buy the deficit. I'm going to stockpile it and I'm going to try and squeeze the market. I mean, he's trying to squeeze the market basically, but he's not saying it because he can't say it. And also at the same time, he bought the URNM ETF. So he's going to control the equities and the and uranium itself. So so uranium itself, given the nuclear, sorry, given the energy crisis in Europe, we all know that the solution is nuclear. There's no other solution. And by designating uranium as green energy, you will see those flows coming from the ESG funds. That's why it's part of my energy basket, because on one hand, I think we can't live without oil. There's also a risk that's flagged by a good guy on Twitter, Josh Young, that there's a risk that OPEC has underinvested. So those deficits, because of OPEC underinvestment, could show in the next few years. So oil, you know, there will be a deficit in oil. So that's one thing. But on the, at the same time, you are risking by only holding oil stocks. You could get fucked by geopolitical risk as well as other factors.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to have something else in there. And that's something else. For me, it's a bit of coal and a bit of uranium. But if I just stay on this side 1 second, because I just want to highlight it again, the importance of, you know, where you have a good asymmetry as well. So the fundamentals versus technicals, right? So uranium, again, I mean, Cameco is on 20 times EBITDA. Alphamin, which is my favorite, you know, tin stock along with Metals X, the only two tin stocks in the world, actually, you know, they're trading on 3 times EBITDA. So again, you have like a 10x different in valuation. Mm-hmm. So that's why I include something like tin in my portfolio as well, because let's put it this way. Sorry, let me just take a step back. So we are talking about an energy transition, right? The energy transition is we're going from oil to nuclear, but also we're going to go to more renewables. More renewables means more copper, more nickel, more tin. And actually the numbers are, if you want to create, if you want to build all those wind farms and you want to build all those Teslas, you need 10 times more nickel, you need 10 times more copper, and you need probably multiple times more tin. So that's why, you know, I don't want to miss big themes like that. And that's why I include those in my portfolio, because if we do have those inflationary forces persisting plus ESG, these things could keep going. But the reason why tin is my favorite is because it's a very small market. There are no deposits. There's no, the supply is getting killed because most of it comes from China, Myanmar, which had a coup, Indonesia, which bizarrely they mine it offshore, like very artisanal mining. And suddenly the only two deposits you have listed in the Western world is you have one in Australia, you have a flooded mine in Cornwall that's going to take a few years to start, and you have an amazing mine in the Congo, but it's in the Congo, so people are afraid to own something in the Congo. But, you know, Alphamin, they have 8% of the world's reserves, and they're printing cash. They're like on 3 times EBITDA, no debt. But, you know, people are afraid to own it because of the Congo. Now, on 3 times EBITDA, compare that to other ESG-type stocks, uranium 20, 30 times, lithium, which is a major component for EV batteries, 30 times EBITDA. So if I own this and just stick to it, mm-hmm. and hopefully someone understands the importance of tin, you know, I see this at, you know, a re-rating as well, because, you know, tin, just as an aside, it's what sticks, you know, everything together. It's the solder that sticks everything together. So take away the solder, it's like everything is going to fall apart. It's like the cement of the modern world. So anyway, so that's that. Sorry for rambling on that direction. But, you know, I'm just trying to get to that. You want to have different bets with different asymmetries in the portfolio. And you want to capture those big themes. So, you know, the energy theme to hedge yourself against a certain thing, the energy crisis. And also, you know, just big themes like energy transition, electric car batteries, which these are inevitable, right? You're not taking a, these are alpha trades in the sense, doesn't matter what, you know, what the S&P or the NASDAQ do, nickel demand is going to go up, copper demand is going to go up, these things are going to go up. The only risk on these things, because I'm asked on it all the time, what's the risk? The risk is that China construction requires a lot of copper, a lot of nickel. So if China construction slows down, you will indeed see a slowdown. You will see a drawdown, a fall in copper and nickel. That's why, again, going back, that's why I like tin specifically, because it has nothing to do with it. So I'll just leave it there.
Talk about the idea of recycling, which is kind of a big part of your thesis. And again, you can kind of go any which way you want to with that. But what is recycling, first of all, and then how does that play into your investment process?
Yeah, so recycling is actually going back to the big trade that you would be tempted to go all in, or like a, you know, Tesla trade that is like, oh, I'm passionate about this. Recycling is probably the closest thing that comes to me. Because it's true ESG in a sense. First of all, I love nature. I love the sea. And it just really, you know, I have my beach house in Cyprus. I have turtles swimming, you know, where our beach is, you know, there's like turtles swimming in there. And, you know, when you swim in the sea, when I was a kid and I was swimming there, it was full of corals, it was full of urchins, mm-hmm. Full of fish. And now that I have a kid and I go swim, there's no corals, there's, you know, less fish. And, it, you know, it pains me to see this. And actually, during the lockdowns, you could see that nature was returning. And those turtles came this year for the first time. So you could see that nature was healing in 1 year. So it does make a big difference. Mm-hmm. This is something that makes a big difference. And it's also, it pains me to see plastic thrown in the sea. It's something that, you know, it really, really bothers me. So, you know, we go with my, and I'm very proud of my four-year-old. When he goes to the beach, he just goes around and picks up garbage and throws them in the bin. So, so recycling has a few big problems and a few promising things. So let's look at the different categories. So steel is something that's very easy to recycle. We actually recycle about 70 to 90% of the world's steel. So we're doing very well on that front. And that's like a $70 to $150 billion industry. Mm-hmm. And that's the easy part. Paper as well. So we recycle 50 to 60% of the world's paper. Of a developed world, and that's a $30-40 billion industry. Now plastic, that's where it becomes difficult. It's a, you know, it's almost $100 billion industry, and we only recycle 14%. Mm-hmm. And I started investing in recycling by just, again, going back to, you know, curiosity. You know, I started from the basics, just finding waste management companies, landfill companies. You know, I found Biffa in the UK, just landfills, waste collection. And I found a small waste management company in Netherlands called Renewi. Mm-hmm. So that was like a three bagger. It's still like on like 5-6 times EBITDA. And that was basically just a waste processing company that was also processing hazardous waste and also slug into building materials. So they were taking it a step further, not just putting in landfills, but also processing into construction material.
Got it.
So that was the first thing. Now then, the rabbit hole came when there was two SPACs. One was Danimer and the other one was PureCycle. And that was in 2020. So that was the first time that I saw, because I saw some private companies that were doing plastics recycling, you know, going back to the point, remember that 14% of plastic is recycled. And Danimer was a SPAC, and then PureCycle was a SPAC. And I was really intrigued by PureCycle. And that was before the SPACs became very hot. Mm-hmm. And it was trading at like, you know, $11 or something. And I did a lot of work with a friend. We collaborated and we did a lot of work on the process. And it was a very interesting company because they were using a mechanical process to create clean plastic. Sorry, I should just say that the problem with recycling plastic is because you have the polyethylene, the PET, and the polypropylene, the PP. Mm-hmm. You can't easily separate them out. So if you take your plastic bottle that you drink your water from, and then the plastic container that you had your food from Walmart, if you recycle them together, what you get is black slug. So the only thing you can make with that black slug is like a plastic bag or like a carpet or something. So the whole difficult, and you know, and that slug sells for like 200 euros a ton, the recycled, the mixed plastic. But if you clean it up, if actually you went to clean up all the white ones and all the, you know, all the PETs and all the PPs, mm-hmm. you would sell that for like 1,000 a ton or 1,500 a ton.
Wow.
That's how much value add you're adding. And that's why I'm excited about the recycling industry of the plastic, because, you know, there's like 100 billion to capture there. So anyway, so we looked at PureCycle, and PureCycle had warrants. And the exciting thing about going back to our conversation about setting up the trade, right?
Yep. Structuring a trade.
Structuring a trade. So it was a so the deal was announced, but it was a pre-vote SPAC. So mm-hmm. you had the downside protection at $10. So with my friend, we loaded up on the warrants. So we looked at the stock and we looked at the warrants. The warrants were like 250. The stock was at 11. And we said, okay, the warrants gives us a right to buy the stock at 11.50. But, you know, if I buy, say, if I buy 10,000 shares of the war of the SPAC, I'm putting $110,000 to work. But if I buy $10,000 of the warrants, I'm putting $25,000 to work for the same exposure, right?
Yep.
So you're taking... Like if you want to put, say, 100 grand to work, you buy 40,000 warrants instead of 10,000 stock, and you get four times the leverage from the warrants.
Yep.
So we loaded up on the warrants, and bear in mind, sorry, the excitement about PureCycle was that they had a mechanical process to separate plastic and keep it clear. So we had basically a few months to work through the trade, and we were building conviction, and we're just buying more and more and more. Mm-hmm. But down the line, one thing I didn't like about it was that they, and you know, there's a problem generally with SPACs. They didn't make it clear that the prototype they were using was like 1/1000th of the size of the final product, of the final prototype. And I know from my engineering, and because I looked at a private deal, that if you have a mechanical process, you can't scale up so easily. So I thought that was a big red flag. Although I was really a believer in the product, I thought it was a red flag. And you know, there was actually another very smart investor that was pushing it. And I was like, you know what? This is actually, I'm not going to carry this after the vote. So we actually sold our position after the as soon as the vote was done. So the stock went from 10 to 18, I think. Mm-hmm. I think the warrants went from like 250. No, sorry, the warrants went from 250 to 18. Roche W was the warrants. Yeah. So we made a killing out of this. It was my best trade this year, by far. By far, actually. So we rode the wave And again, it's structure. So, okay, let's recap the lesson. So the structure,
yep.
So the downside was all the capital I put in the warrants. That was my downside,
yep.
Okay? Because the warrants can go to zero. That's fine, that's one. And ICE and the structure was put the capital you wanna risk through the warrants instead of putting your hard-earned capital through the stock. So that was the second thing. The third thing was the timeline. So the timeline was, I'm going to ride this trade until the vote, because after the vote, I lose my put. And I was lucky enough that there was a very, you know, well-respected investor that was saying, this is a multi-bagger, great, fine, whatever. I sold everything. And I think the stock is back to, I don't know where it is, like 10, 12, whatever. I don't really care, because I know that this thing is very tough to work. But during this work, so this is, I think, where I love Twitter. I was, some guy on Twitter said, what's the big themes you love? And I said, recycling. I say, and the guy was like, oh, what do you love in recycling? I think it was my buddy Wasteland Capital or something.
Yeah, it's a good dude.
I'm trying to get him on the podcast,
I love him, by the way.
I know. And he'd be like, when he read that I was on the podcast, I think he did like a face palm. He's like, oh yeah, you dude, you're the only one who hasn't been on a podcast yet. You got to jump on. But yep. Anyway, so he was like, okay, what do you like? And I said, I like Renewi. And I think, I think he liked that. So Renewi was the one I said, it was this 5-6 times EBITDA value stock. And I said, I like this pure cycle, mm-hmm. Which I was long at the time. And then this guy on Twitter, he says, then you should look at Digimarc. And he sent me a whole presentation that I completely ignored initially.
What's the ticker symbol for that?
DMRC. So he sends me this whole presentation that this ex-Kotu guy did, guy called Riley McCormack, about Digimarc. And I glanced through it and I was like, I don't get it. And I ignored it. And then bizarrely, I went back to my tweet a few weeks later. And you know, this guy I worked with on Roche, he's another private investor on PureCycle. So I was like, we're like, well, we need to find more stuff on recycling. You know, we're getting out of this one. We need to find more stuff. So I went back to the tweet to see this company. And yeah. I went through this presentation and I sent it to him. And I'm like, holy shit, this thing, if it works, it's like 10 bagger conservatively.
Right.
So what it does is Digimarc is a company that does a digital watermark, which is basically like a barcode that you put across the whole package, and you don't, it's an invisible barcode that you put across the whole thing. And actually, the technology was developed for banknotes. And Digimarc, most of the world's central banks, I think 19 out of the top 25 or 20, whatever it is, mm-hmm. they use digital watermark on their banknotes. So if you take your banknote, there's a watermark on it, digital watermark. And the watermark contains a lot of information. It's not just a QR code. It has a lot of information. You can embed a video on it. That's why central banks use it.
Yeah.
So Digimarc makes like between 10, 15 million, I can't remember, I think it's like somewhere in the middle, per year from having this technology on banknotes. Now, this guy who sent me the pitch, he was mentioning as well that that Walmart is using this technology to speed up their checkout. And I saw some videos, I went down the rabbit hole, I found videos on YouTube where you can scan, if you scan things with a barcode, so you're a checker, right? Whatever you call it. So if you check out things on the till, mm-hmm. you need to find the barcode and you scan one by one. If you have everything with a digital watermark, you just literally pass the things through and it scans it. So you speed up this massively. And I think we estimated that Walmart would save like, you know, multiple billions by having this, by speeding up by the whole process.
Yeah.
Now, that was the one thing. The second thing that was exciting about, and going back to the recycling, that was that there was an initiative called the Holy Grail 2, where major companies took part, like Procter & Gamble, was leading it, L'Oreal, I think Pepsi was in it, whereby they were trying to tackle the recycling problem. Mm-hmm. And it was initiated by the MacArthur Foundation. And Ellen MacArthur is this famous Olympic winner sailor that she got every credit to her. I mean, I want to meet this woman. She was passionate about recycling and she put all these companies together and said, we need to deal with plastic. Mm-hmm. And to deal with plastic, we need to find a way to separate PET and PP. And all these guys came together and they said, we're going to trial digital watermarks in our products. And it's been ongoing for a few years. And going back to the timeline trade, the trials were done at an industrial scale this year. Mm-hmm. They were done in November and December. You can find the videos online and it looks really impressive. But basically, there's a company called Tomra in Norway that does the sorting machines.
Are they public?
I actually spoke. Yeah, they're public. If you see the chart, it looks like a SaaS stock. It's incredible. And
what's
actually
the one mistake I did,
Tomra, so it's T-O-M-R-A in Norway. Let me find the ticker.
I just actually DM'd you so I could remember it. So I just DM'd you. Tomra.
Yeah, yes.
I love these Nordic companies, by the way. There's one that I'll send you off air. That's very venture like, that fits this that fits this recycling environmental theme that you got going on. And I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about it, because if you hate it, I definitely would want to know why.
No, exactly. No, please do. I mean, Tomra is an amazing company, and I'm an idiot for not buying it, because I actually spoke to them during the research on Digimarc, and I was very impressed with them. So the ticker is TOM space NO in Norway. They basically have, they are the dominant player in sorting conveyor belts, also in mining, by the way. So they have these amazing conveyor belts whereby, you know, in stage one, you separate out the steel, stage two, you separate out, you know, aluminium, stage three, you separate out something else. And then by introducing the watermark on plastic, you can separate out the food contaminated plastic with non-food contaminated plastic.
Wow.
Which basically makes, it's a game changer for the world. That's why this is really exciting to me. And that's why I went down the rabbit hole of this company. Because going back to my point, there's a lot of benefits. So the benefits are, so they did the industrial trials with Tomra. It worked. In H1 next year, we're going to see digital watermarks on products of Procter & Gamble, Pepsi, on the shelves in Europe. I'm not sure when in the US, but you know, Walmart should have been first, to be honest. And if you see, that's when I love going deeper in research, is when, you know, with my friend, we spoke to Tomra, we spoke to various people around it or possible users to understand where the applications could be. And also you see videos on LinkedIn of the Pepsi guy saying, oh my God, this is amazing. So the Pepsi executive, he looks at the thing separate and is like, oh my God, this is amazing. So so it does a lot of things. Let me just clarify a few reasons why, because these things, they take a long time to get implemented. Mm-hmm. So for example, the barcode was invented in the 50s. It took 20 years to get implemented. So the risk you have with an investment like this, you can end up buying it and just getting stuck with this shit, right?
Yeah.
So the reason why to the timeline trade, first of all, the old management was slow. And the main holder, which is this guy, Riley McCormack, he kicked them out and took over. So I saw that as a trigger. So as an event-driven guy, I'm like, you know what? New management, they're going to start pushing. So I bought more when the guy was became CEO. And also there was a nice clean timeline from the Holy Grail. They said, you know what? Trials in November, trials in December, things on the shelf in early 22. So I have a timeline. I'll be writing this timeline in the next 12 months. That's the first thing. The second thing is the value add from a mixed plastic of 200 euros a ton to increase the value add at 1,000, 1,500 euros a ton. There's a clear incentive for recyclers to get involved. Two, and then three, the Holy Grail is not just an initiative out of kindness. In Europe, because we're so ESG driven, there is gonna be a plastics tax. So we have already a carbon tax. There's a plastics tax that's coming that could be severe. And I think all these companies, they realize that it's not only a social benefit, because you know every major company wants to show that they're environmentally friendly right now, right? I mean, they have a young consumers, and the young consumers, they do care about their credentials, but they also care about financials. So you're gonna have a perfect storm, whereby you will have financial incentives and ESG incentives for this thing to work. Now, if it works, what's it worth? Well, it's a $600, $700 million company. They have $70 million in cash. They bought a company, which is no point going through that now, but they already have a business that's making money, the central bank banknote business. If you put that on 15 times or whatever, 20 times, then that business itself, you know, that business could be worth $200-300 million itself. Mm-hmm. So basically, if you strip all that out, well, you're buying something that could become the new barcode for, you know, $300 million or something. Could that be a 10x? Yeah. Could it be a 100x? Yeah, it could be a 100x. Do I have other stocks like that in my portfolio? No. If it goes to zero, will I care? No. But if it works, I'll make a killing. So to my point is, it's the only stock like that I have in my portfolio. It doesn't have a nice multiple. You know, it's like on very high multiple to sales, but I don't have any SaaS stocks. I don't have any, you know, I don't have any other crazy stocks. So I can have one crazy stock that could change the world. Right. And, you know, this is the one I have. And I really hope for our sake, I think this is where I'm excited, because I really hope this thing works for our benefit.
Right.
And it's awesome. So elegant. Like, I really want you to go and look at the videos. It's like, it's really cool if it works out.
Yeah, I will. I mean, I love ideas like that. I love these, you know, kind of big, and this kind of fits into your philosophy, like these big thematic ideas that then you drill down and you find these companies doing interesting things. You know, we're almost actually at 2 hours in the podcast, which has kind of flown by.
Oh shit!
But I know, right?
I've asked for an hour because
I know, right? It's a long time. So I'm gonna get to kind of our concluding questions here before we sign off. So first thing I have for you, what are you most excited about in 2022? Like, it doesn't have to be investing related. It could be personal development. It could be anything along those sorts. Like, what has you excited about next year?
I'm very family focused. So I'm excited because I just had a second baby. So I'm really looking forward to that. Because at the end of the day, you know what I mean? I love what I'm doing, and I'm doing it. I'm having fun while I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So I don't think of it as work almost. And I love to spend time with my kids while working. And, you know, I'm teaching my kid, he looks at charts and he gets excited. but you know, I'm actually excited about my portfolio, to be honest, as well, because I like having these very low cheap stocks with something like a sprinkle of a Digimarc that I hope works for next year.
Yeah.
I'm also very cautious, as you know, because I think the tapering, the tapering ending in March, I think we're going to have a few big swings. So I really want people to be nimble, and I don't want them to own a lot of shit, because shit is going to get killed. That's why I always make it clear, guys, like, please, I don't own a lot of shit. I own one potential 100 bagger or zero. I'm not going to call it shit, because it's not, but, you know, just clean up your portfolios, you know, be sensible. It's going to be a tough year, but it's going to be exciting. I mean, these are the years that you make a lot of money.
Yep.
You know, I'm going to have fun on the way as well.
Awesome. All right. One couple last questions here. Where can people go to find out more about you? I know you're on Twitter. So if you again want to plug your Twitter handle real quick.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. So it's Shrubbery Capital. I changed it to strawberry stagflation, strawberry 1984, whatever the theme is. But you know, I enjoy getting messages from young guys, young girls that want to learn more about that have questions about investing. I just want to make sure that, you know, it's like both males and females should be excited about investing. It should be part of their routine. Helps them retire earlier if they do it well. Mm-hmm. Helps them build wealth. So I'm very open to answering DMs, as people who hear this know. Yeah, I think this Twitter has a give and take relationship. I got a lot out of it. So that's why I make an effort to help people when I can.
Terrific. And then last question that I ask everybody, if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Jimi Hendrix.
Nice. We have not had that.
All the way.
We're almost at like 200 episodes on this, or you know, maybe over 100 episodes on this thing, and no one said Jimi Hendrix. So I appreciate that.
And Jimi Hendrix is like, oh, I mean, you're having it's going to be drinks, maybe not dinner. Because, you know, you're like having, I mean, I I play guitar. I collect guitars. I'm very passionate about my music. I wish I could play more. I mean, because my kid hates it when I play guitar, unfortunately, but you know, Jimmy would be phenomenal.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks so much again, Shrub, for doing this. This was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. I know other people will. And again, you know, best of luck in 2022 and wish you, you know, nothing but success. And thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks, Brandon. I really enjoyed it.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.